Go even farther back in time to my, even beyond my birthday, to when my wife and I were married 31 years ago. Seems amazing to me. We were very young and naive, and for 7 years we lived in a utopian environmentalist community in New York State. We lived in a very small space, just 700 square feet. We didn't have a car or a lawn. We did our grocery shopping on foot, and when we had to travel longer distances, we traveled by public transportation. We, our electric bill worked out to just a dollar a day. We had no large appliances. The utopian community was Manhattan. We lived at 69th and 2nd in an apartment on the 14th floor of a red brick high rise. I think most Americans, even most New Yorkers, are used to thinking of the city as an environmental disaster area. It's all concrete and diesel fumes and noise and traffic jams. But by the most significant measures, New York City, I believe, is the greenest community in the United States and one of the greenest in the world. New Yorkers consume gasoline at the lowest rate in the United States, it's 90 gallons a year versus something like a national average of 450. Vermont, which was voted the number one greenest state in the country by Forbes, has a per capita average of 550 gallons. New York State, entirely because of New York City, has the lowest per capita electricity use in the country. New Yorkers are the lowest per capita electricity users. If the New York City is larger in population than all but 11 states, if you made it a state, it would rank 51st in per capita energy use in all categories. New Yorkers are low per capita users of water. They're low per capita generators of solid waste. They have the smallest carbon footprint in the country, about 7.5 metric tons per person versus the national average of almost 25. New York City's per capita carbon footprint isn't quite what Sweden's is, but Manhattan's is. For the country as a whole to achieve the New York City carbon footprint would require a national reduction of 70%, which is considerably more than anything anybody's talking about doing. New York City residents are also the largest consumers of public transportation in the country by far. Almost a third of all the public transit passenger miles traveled in the United States are traveled in the metropolitan New York City region. New York has half of all the subway stops in the United States. I can't remember exactly what this exactly which the line is, but it's a single bus route in New York City accounts for more transit passenger miles than the second largest transit system in the United States, the second largest bus transit system in the United States. The key to all these environmental wonders is population density. New York City is by far the densest place in the United States. Manhattan's density is about almost 70,000 people per square mile, which is far beyond the rest of the country. It's 30 times Los Angeles, 5 times Chicago. The density is critical because it makes possible everything. It's density of people and of destinations. When you put people close together, you make public transit work. When you put people close together, you make it possible for them to get from one place to another on foot or by bus or by subway. You make efficient transit possible, and you do achieve probably the key element, which is to break the chain of dependence, the American dependence on the automobile. New Yorkers are by far the least intoxicated automobile owners in the United States. The more than half of New York City households don't own a car. In the rest of the country, it's basically zero. 77% of Manhattan households don't own a car. And New Yorkers don't use cars the way other people do. Manhattanites tend to use them on weekends to get out of the city, and they don't drive terribly far in them. People in the outer boroughs tend to use them to infrequently and to shop. And multiple car ownership is in a family is a rarity. In the rest of the country, in 2001, we crossed a sort of sinister threshold. That was the year that the number of registered vehicles in the United States for the first time exceeded the number of licensed drivers. So we have more cars than we have drivers. That was came close to being true in my family, but not quite. All these I think environmentally significant facts, I began to think about them 25 years ago when my wife and I moved away from New York City. We had a daughter when we were living in the city in 1984, and by 1985 she had morphed into this very active person, and we decided that we didn't want to bring her up in a city, and we moved about 100 miles north to a small town in Connecticut, a town of about 4,000 people. We live in a 200-year-old house. We live in a recycled house. We live across a dirt road from a 4,000-acre nature preserve. I've seen a bear in my yard. There are deer and raccoons and everything else. There's a stream down at the bottom of the hill, and I can hear it rushing by. There's a 19th century railroad tunnel that I can walk to from my door without crossing only one paved road. And it seemed like when we moved to Connecticut that we had stepped into Arcadia. But in fact, our move was an environmental disaster. We went from owning no cars to owning one car, our first car, and then immediately realized that one car wasn't enough. Because if you have one car, you can't pick up your car from the mechanic and you take it home to have it serviced. And then we got a second car, and then we acquired a third car as a result of a mild midlife crisis of mine. And then when our two kids became old enough to drive, that car became a necessity. The people who live in the city and imagine rural life picture doing things like going for walks and kayaking down rivers and hiking through the woods and gathering eggs from your own chickens. But what you really do when you move out of the city is move into a car and move your children into car seats. We went from driving close to 0 miles a year to driving initially about 30,000 miles a year between us. My kids are grown now, but my wife and I still drive 20,000 miles a year, which is just about the national average for a family. We almost everything we do outside of our house involves a car trip, because when you live in a small, low-density area, there's virtually no place that's accessible by bicycle or on foot, and there's no public transit because there's no conceivable way to organize an efficient public transit system when people live so far from each other. When we lived in New York City, our pediatrician, the office of our pediatrician was in the office of our apartment building, which a fact that did not encourage self-reliant parenting, but that was extraordinarily convenient because elevators are among the most fuel-efficient passenger vehicles in the world. Now where we live in Connecticut, my dentist is two towns away. It's a round trip by car of 32 miles. The nearest movie theater to where we live is a 20-minute drive away. So is the nearest large grocery store. When we used to get DVDs from Blockbuster, it was a 2-gallon per movie investment because the nearest Blockbuster was 10 miles away and every rental involved 2 round trips. The the difference was striking, and as I thought about this, and a useful way to judge any human activity is to multiply it by 300 million if you're an American, or by, if you're thinking globally, by 7 billion going up to 9 billion. And clearly the life that this pleasant seeming, surrounded by green life that we were living in our small town in Connecticut doesn't scale, whereas dense urban life does. And as we think about the various gathering environmental crises that the world faces, it seems clear to me that one of the few certain tools that we have at our disposal is urban density and the compacting of human beings, in effect, of making them more efficient by moving them closer together. It's a concept that not everybody finds easy to think about. There are several reactions that I've had from people as I talk about this, as I've got around talking about it. One reaction is a sort of, no way, and then, oh yeah, duh. It's like immediately from, that's impossible to, oh yeah, it's obvious. That's one reaction. Another that I experienced in Portland, Oregon is a kind of, you know, put up your dukes, New York versus Portland. And I was saying, no, it's really not about which city is greener. It's more like, let's see if we can understand what it is that actually reduces carbon footprint. And it's not the way they think about it in Portland, and they want to fight. I talked to a group of graduate students at Yale in the forestry department who were completely appalled by the idea that it was even possible to talk about green that wasn't a discussion of a deep personal commitment to veganism and a particular lifestyle. It's like the difference between works and faith, or works and grace, that it doesn't matter what you do, or it doesn't matter what the result is, it's all what you do. I can't figure out which one would be which. But for them, it was intention was everything and results meant nothing. I talked to someone in New York City at a talk in New York City who said, well, I explained this idea to him, and he said, but it's just because everybody's all crammed together. And I said, yeah, that's it, exactly. And he said, but it's all unconscious. And I said that it's the best environmental results are the unconscious ones, because you don't have to enforce them. You don't have to alter human nature in order to bring them about. The efficiency of New Yorkers, the small carbon footprint, is simply a result of the way New Yorkers live. It's not because New Yorkers have undergone a green karmic transformation and now go around turning off lights and unplugging things. It's just a natural consequence of what happens when people live in spaces that are too small and live close enough to their neighbors and to their daily destinations that they don't need a car. There are also some paradoxical green characteristics of New York. There are some things about New York that make it green, that make it efficient, and that keep the carbon footprint small, that seem like opposite talk when you bring them up to people. One of them is what people, I think, most often think of as a terrible environmental problem, which is the congestion on the streets of New York, traffic congestion. And it looks like an environmental problem, but in fact, congestion on the streets of New York is one of the things that makes the subway work. If using a car in New York City were humanly rational, more people would do it and would be less inclined to use the subway. I think everybody who's visited New York has had the experience of sitting in a taxi cab and watching a little old lady on the sidewalk overtake you and disappear over the horizon. And that fact, that experience, is what makes the subway work. I think the thing that we've seen over and over again is that a city can have the most magnificent transit system that federal funds can build, and yet it remains unused or heavily underused if there is any possibility whatsoever that people can get to where they're going by car. New York City is one of the only places in the United States where you'll hear someone say, we better take the subway, we don't have time to take a cab. It's not really true anyplace else in the country, and it goes a long way toward explaining the extraordinary drop-off, the Tiger Woods-like drop-off from the success of New York City's public transit system to everybody else. Washington, D.C. is a good counterexample. It's often mentioned by people as the most beautiful American city, the most European American city. It was laid out at almost exactly the same time New York City was, right about the turn of the 19th century, the early 1800s. It's beautiful, but environmentally it's terrible. It was not designed for the automobile, but it was easily adapted to it. The broad streets were easily adapted to cars. The statutory limit on building height keeps the density relatively low. When you make a city low, you make it wide. It's like pouring water across the floor. The traffic circles are difficult to negotiate on foot. I was in the large public spaces, these tremendous parks and great malls, which look tremendous on Google Earth, for example, and are wonderful places to walk around in, but they make the city very hard to get around on foot. They're what you mentioned, Jane Jacobs, earlier in The Death and Life of Great American Cities, when she talked about border vacuums, which is impediments to pedestrian traffic, the things that halt the flow of human activity in a city. And there are many of the large public spaces in Washington, D.C. have that same function, as do things like DuPont Circle and the wide streets. You're thwarted every time you try to go someplace. Washington, D.C., most of it also doesn't have the tremendously fertile mix of uses that you find in the liveliest parts of Manhattan, where you have within a block, you have, I once wrote a little humor piece in the New Yorker. This was in the early days of the internet, and I claimed that the internet was actually plagiarized, the World Wide Web was plagiarized from New York City, and that the hyperlink was a Manhattan invention, and that the evidence of it was that in every block in New York there was a door through which you could enter the same Chinese restaurant. And what you have in New York is in the places that function the best are you walk out of your building and there's a grocery store across the street, probably two grocery stores. There's a shoe repair store, and try even finding a shoe repair store in the rest of the United States. There's maybe a liquor store in your very own building, a doctor's office, a series of doctor's offices. All these destinations right in a residential neighborhood, which is completely contrary to the guiding principle by which we built most of the rest of the country. There are the parts of New York that function the best are the places where the uses are the most mixed up. I'm the chairman of the zoning commission in the little town where I live, and we devote all our effort to keeping uses widely separated. Our regulations are a blueprint for sprawl, and that's had the effect that they've had, not only in our little town, but all across the country. I think that it's useful but difficult to talk about environmentalism in these terms, to talk about the environment in these terms, and to talk about environmental strategies in these terms. The case that I try to make in the book is that what we need to do, the challenge we face, is to as this country grows, to encourage that growth to take place where we usefully increase density in places where it is most useful to increase it, and that we provide disincentives to to the kind of way that we have developed the country, which is basically just spreading out. I grew up in Kansas City, which the Sierra Club selected as, I think, as, I don't know, it was maybe the number one, but it was one of the top five, certainly, most sprawl threatened cities in the United States. It has, according to the, I think this is from the Sierra Club, it has more highway miles per capita than any other municipality in the United States. I know that when I was a kid, which was a long time ago, not that long ago, the places where we used to drive out to do bad things because we were so far away that no one would see us, now we're so far in town that they're practically downtown. Places where we used to go park and smoke bad things are now the cookie cutter residential subdivisions that have become practically little mini communities of their own. They're this just sprawling mass that has spread across the Midwest. One of the great differences between a city like Kansas City and New York City is that in Kansas City there are no natural, there's no Hudson River and East River, there are no natural barriers to horizontal growth. There's really nothing between, to stop Kansas City, between Lake Michigan and the Gulf of Mexico. It's pretty much wide open country for both of them, and that's the way they've been growing. I think instead we tend to, in terms of policy and in terms of the way we think about the environment, we tend to engage in and pursue dead-end strategies or strategies that actually leave us worse off than we were before. Americans are very good at solutions that involve buying things. We're always happy to buy a new car or redo the kitchen with bamboo cabinets, or eat better tasting tomatoes. These are the kinds of environmental solutions that we like. And we're not good at any solution that involves less. I think that explains, for example, the tremendous popularity of the Prius, the Toyota Prius. There's a series of Prius commercials, which I'm especially fond of, and if I had a PowerPoint presentation, I would be showing you so you can imagine this. But there's a Prius commercial in which a Prius is driving through a colorless landscape, and as it passes, the colorless landscape bursts into color and becomes green, and it reflects and encourages this idea that I think is very widespread, which is that as you drive your hybrid car, you are actively performing a service to humanity and the environment. You're like vacuuming things out of you're leaving it better than it was before you passed by. And there are a number of consumer goods that we think of as green that behave in that way. But the argument I make in the book is that miles per gallon are almost beside the point, that although mile for mile, an efficient car is better than an inefficient car, nevertheless, when we increase the efficiency of our machines, we're also reducing the cost of operating them, and we tend to use them more. And increasing the efficiency of our devices is of no use to the environment if that's all we do. If we aren't also, you have to keep your foot on the other side as well, and I think the strongest evidence for that we saw in 2008 when the price of oil got very high and the world's economies imploded. And what we saw then was something that I think even the most optimistic environmentalists in the world hadn't been anticipating, hadn't been expecting by any means, which was an actual significant measurable drop in the world's carbon footprint. It actually shrank by something like 2.5%. That was the result not of any investment by governments into green technologies or green programs. It was simply a result of the fact that energy got expensive and people had less money, and they use less of it. People who have lost their jobs or are worried about their jobs turn down their thermostats, they stop heating their swimming pool, they drive fewer miles, factories that are shuttered spew less carbon into the atmosphere. All these things happen. And I think we see also that when things turn in the other direction, the opposite happens. And we're seeing it, I've noticed it right now today on the front page of the New York Times. There's an article about the recovery of General Motors and how they have suddenly $50 billion in cash that they're know what to do with, that they now have to invest in the future. And one of the major things that they're investing it in is in new models of SUVs and pickup trucks. So even, it's not just that people don't remember the 70s, people don't remember earlier this year. And I think in some ways that's one of the best things about the human race, this amazing ability we have to pick ourselves up and go on after setbacks. But it's also sort of a discouraging fact about human beings, the fact that we are able to just pretty much compartmentalize what we know and put it aside and go on as before. I think I'm probably at the point where I'm just going to talk in circles, and I might take some questions if there are any, and if they're not, then I can go on my own. Yes.
I'm sympathetic to your point of view, but I have three qualms or things that I think should be taken into account. One is that if you look at New York City holistically, it's not just Manhattan and skyscrapers. It's the center of a large megalopolis that includes Long Island and large swaths of New Jersey. And in a way, the two have to be looked at as a whole, and they sort of make each other possible. And I grew up in Queens, which was farmland, and then it paved over up to the Montauk system since then. The other thing is that there's another epiphenomenon of urban life, which is that if you take neighborhoods like the South Bronx or Harlem, the asthma rates are the highest in the country. And that relates to my third point, which is that does one factor in all the vacations that people in New York can afford to take all over the place and all the flying miles? So there's something about the density which also creates a lack of biophilic possibilities, to use Ian Wilson's term. So I think one has to look at it more holistically, even though by and large it's right. There are, factors that have to be looked at.
I agree. I'll talk about both of them. The first, I've already forgotten exactly what you said. But yes, I think that those figures do take into account that idea takes into account the interrelatedness of all these places. It's very hard with any place to separate those out. I mean, the networks of consumption and energy use that we have are tremendous and undisentanglable. Nevertheless, I think the core facts are that if you want to make public transit work, you have to move people and their destinations close together. If you, there was somebody I talked to in Portland, who came to a talk I gave in Portland, who had offered what I think is a good measure of what makes a walkable city, for example. New York City is one of the last places in the United States where walking is a primary form of transportation. It may be the last place in the United States where walking is a primary, many people's primary form of transportation. He said what you need is a walkable grocery store, and I think that's true. So there's a threshold density that makes transit work, that makes walking work, that makes efficiencies work. And it's pretty dense, and it involves tall buildings, which is a good reason to be talking about this here. On the second point, you're exactly right, and it's even worse than you say, because density, in addition to making people efficient, makes disasters efficient too. It makes asthma efficient, if indeed that's one of the causes of it. But there are many other things that diseases of all kinds, crowds are not good for them. If we ever suffer bioweapons attack, places like New York City will be much more vulnerable than others. The plague, all the sort of the great disasters of human history have always hit hardest in cities. Density has a tremendous downside, and I know very well. I moved away from it in order to get away from it. And for those reasons, I think that when we talk about environmental solutions, we can't talk, it's not a single list. There are different lists in different places. In dense cities, if there is environmental value to putting people close together, then I think that the critical environmental issues in a place like New York are not things like solar panels on buildings or LEED designated buildings or any of those things. I think it's things like education, it's crime, it's the health issues we talk about. I think that also there are a number of issues that we think of as that we think of as standard environmental issues like air quality. Globally, New York City is a great global citizen in terms of what it puts into the air. We contribute less per person than many other parts of the country. Locally, the air is a problem. If you live in New York City, I know when we lived here, we were constantly washing things that we no longer have to wash where we live now. And I found out that the rug we had in our living room was a completely different color from what I had come to think that it was when we lived in New York City. Noise is an issue in New York City, and it's a potential deal breaker for somebody living in the city. So I think there are all those things, and I think probably education is a super critical one. It's what sends people fleeing away from places that are served by public transit and out to places, these inefficient places. So yeah, I agree with all those things.
Myself, education did the opposite. I flee to a sprawling area and I moved to an urban area and I haven't lived that.
That's good. Well, my daughter now lives in New York City in an apartment that is about the size of her childhood bedroom. I think there's one thing that I think where the mainstream traditional American sort of environmental movement has let us down is by perpetuating or creating and perpetuating the idea that there's something depraved, that urban life is depraved, and that it's inauthentic. And it goes back to Henry David Thoreau and John Muir and the idea that you aren't alive until you're out of the city. I think it would make more sense for the future of the globe for us to look at our environmental problems from the opposite direction, and to think, instead of doing what we normally do, which is to think, how do we throw up barricades around these places that we want to protect? It makes more sense to think, how do we intelligently organize the places where people are? And in fact, that's the way you create those places that you want to protect, by putting the people on. The example I like to give regarding Vermont, which is that if you spread New York City, the 8.3 million residents of New York City out at the population density of Vermont, you would need a land area equal to that of Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Delaware, New Jersey, Maryland, and Virginia. And then, of course, you'd have to find places to put all of those people. So when people talk about urban sprawl, they're doing a disservice to urban. It's not an urban phenomenon. It's a suburban phenomenon. It's an outer urban phenomenon. And I think it's driven by this idea, I'll just pick the Sierra Club to blame it on, by the Sierra Club notion, by that this form of environmental notion that in order to be alive, I need to be in direct contact with what I consider to be nature, what I call nature, which is what drove my wife and me before we lived. But if you do that, in order to replicate that experience, the next person has to move a little bit beyond you. Someone said to me, sprawl is driven by people escaping sprawl, and it's not a strategy that has an endpoint. It's self-replicating. Are there, yes.
Do you think there is a critical density where these environmental benefits begin to accrue? For instance, Los Angeles is a large city. I think you mentioned the population density is about 1/30th of Manhattan's. Does Los Angeles begin to see any environmental benefits for being a city that's denser than the rest of the country, or are they basically like everybody else?
No, they definitely have, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but they're much denser than most places in the United States, and they have the same, they have proportionately, they have, an Angeleno's carbon footprint is smaller than other people's. There's lots to dislike about Los Angeles, but the it's more efficient than, for example, well, than Kansas City. It's more denser.
Sort of a little bit of density is better than no density, and more density is better than a little bit of, you know, it's sort of sliding continuous scale where there's always some benefits that accrue by having a greater density, regardless of where you start.
I don't think it's continuous. I think the way I kind of think of it, I don't think there would be any gain to the globe of increasing the density of this 4,000 person town where I live. I think that ideally from a global perspective would be to freeze it and let, because by definition almost anybody who's moving there is moving from someplace more dense, and although you're increasing local density, you're just sort of, it's as though you have an inefficient machine and you're running it longer. I think you would sort of draw a line of median density and try to increase the density of the denser places and just and let the rest stop. I think there's also a sort of a discontinuity at the other end too, where people sometimes say that as you increase density, transit use will rise to a certain point and then it plateaus and there is no point in increasing density beyond that point, say by having buildings taller than four stories. Sometimes four stories is the limit that people will talk about. We shouldn't go any taller than that. But actually what happens is that, you see in New York, is that if you increase density to a certain point, even transit becomes inefficient, is perceived as inefficient by residents, and they start to walk. So I think that the benefits of density continue and extend and grow beyond points where people think, well, this is enough. We don't need to get any denser than this. The thing that amazes me when I think about it is that the nearest walking destination from my house now, from my back door, is my mailbox, which is 150 yards from my back door. Within 150 yards of the door of our apartment building on Second Avenue, I had two grocery stores, a Gristiti's and a food emporium, and then all these other places, plus the residences of thousands of people who were almost entirely strangers, but potentially of all these people that you could have seen. So it's a great engine if you can arrange it right. Unfortunately, well, I think most of the times when we try to do it on purpose, we end up with something that's wrong. Dubai is a good example in the news lately of a good example of something I've referred to as density sprawl. It's just it's a completely irrational kind of density. It's an almost phenomenally automobile dependent city. It looks like, from Google Earth, it looks like Manhattan in many ways, but you can't get around without a car. I've stayed in three different hotels in Dubai, and there's literally no place that I could go to any of the three on foot. There was no walkable destination. You go out into this phlegm-colored air and get into the most astonishing traffic jam, which is made worse by the fact that they're constantly, maybe not now, that they're the sort of Ponzi scheme that financed the whole thing has fallen apart. But the nightmare traffic was made even more nightmarish by the fact that they were constantly tearing apart and trying to expand existing roadways to make them bigger and build more overpasses and things like that. So I think it would be better to freeze the less dense places and densify and intelligently densify not only in people but also in destinations. It's not only density of citizens but density of places to go. Yes.
So if let's say frustrated President Obama's coming back from Copenhagen on his plane and read your book and calls you to Washington now, are you advising him? Are you going to be, would you be telling him, okay, take your education budget and give half of this to New York and take all this federal highway money, invest it in public transit in New York and change some of the other tax incentives that allow people to rebuild, doing more sprawl and put it more into building up places and into giving people an opportunity to invest in New York?
I think it's too bad. I think that the stimulus funds, if we're going to invest in infrastructure, we should be investing it in where we want to get to, which would be in helping to investing it in urban cores, in the sort of the places with the greatest potential to achieve walkable transit dependent areas, which would be in cities. Instead, we've kind of done the opposite. It tends to be things like building roads
encouraging people to buy cars and to build ever more houses. So I guess I would say that, and I would also say that I think that the simple tool, we saw what it was in 2008, which is that has to do with how you price energy. And if you price energy correctly, then people make good decisions. You know, although the things that happened in 2008, automobile transit miles went down, public transit use went up, carbon footprint went down, we killed the Hummer, at least temporarily. The automobile companies went into bankruptcy. The price of gasoline in this country didn't even get to half of what it was in Europe. And all these effects reverberated through our country, all these good environmental effects. And yet the political response was basically that we must make this stop immediately. There were cries that we have to stop taxing fuel at the state level to drive the price back down. We should release oil from the National Strategic Reserve. We have to put pressure on OPEC to drive the price of oil back down. So politically, I don't know that there's a possibility of anything happening. But my preference would be I think cap and trade is too susceptible to this hocus pocus and self-delusion, and would be more in favor of a carbon-adjusted energy tax. And there are ways to do it that make it revenue neutral. I like this idea that there were a couple of people at EPA, and then there was somebody on the op-ed page for the James Henson, tax and dividends, or whatever you call it, where you tax energy and then you return the money to people, basically at the median level, so that if you're using less than the median, you come out ahead. If you're using more than the median, you have an incentive to cut back. It's on the same principle as a babysitter payment method devised by some people that I know. There was a couple that were entertaining people in their house. Their babysitter wasn't available at the last minute. She had two young sons. She was worried that they were just going to be a problem at the party. So she gave them each five $1 bills and told them that they could come downstairs in an emergency, of course, but that for any other reason, every time they came downstairs, they had to pay her a dollar. They played nicely by themselves all the time. They had the money in their hand, and they were actually just paying it up. Solutions of all kinds, so all kinds of problems tend to work better when you are harnessing human nature rather than trying to change it. So my advice would be to think of ways to do that. That's completely impossible, I'm sure.
I pretty much speculate that the whole speculative bubble in oil collapsed, at the end of 2008 because, for the first time in decades, Americans actually cut the number of miles they drive, and that scared the bejesus out of powers that be.
Maybe. We didn't cut them by that much. But we did cut them by some amount.
It was actually cut instead of going up no matter what the price.
Yeah. We'll see. The world's oil consumption is still climbing. But I do know that when I got my first delivery of home heating oil at $4.83 a gallon, I took up the insulation project that I've been putting off for 25 years. And then as soon as it went back down below $2, I stopped immediately. Yes?
I just wanted to touch on your premise of density is good for the environment, right? And you have density because individuals are making choices. And you cited Kansas City as a place where people are making a different choice,
yes,
rather than New York. And you talked about some of the maybe dominant factors in that choice, which is crime, education, and public health. So what factors could you change to make more people choose to live in a dense environment?
Well, I think you unbury the costs of sprawl, for one thing. In addition, I mentioned addressing the urban issues that drive people out of cities. I think you have to also address the economic incentives that we provide to people to live in inefficient ways. And there are lots of them, and they're mostly hidden. Many of them have to do with the automobile. The thing I argue in the book is that the critical energy drain in a suburb is not the Hummer in the driveway, it's the driveway. It's everything that the Hummer makes possible and necessary. It's this huge infrastructure network of roads and sewage treatment and power generation and schools and malls and all this duplicated, redundant, inefficient infrastructure that we require as we spread out. If things we did made were economically rational, we wouldn't spread out like that because it's extraordinarily costly and inefficient. But the reason we do it is that we actually create incentives to people to do that. The cheap land is always at the margins. We bring the roads out to meet it. We bring the utilities out to meet it. Instead of concentrating the cost on the people who create these expenses, we tend to encourage it. We often give them tax breaks in order to do this because we view that kind of growth as a great boon. Kansas City certainly is the example I give in the book is the Sprint corporate campus in Kansas City, which is way out beyond where we used to go to get high when I was a kid. And it's this huge LEED certified sprawl bomb. I can't remember how many buildings. I think there are 19 buildings and 20 parking garages, and on a 200-acre campus, and they preserve open space. But it required this massive, it dragged with it as it went, this huge sort of mantle of infrastructure, including suburban subdivisions. The counterexample is a building that I use in the book, is a building right here in New York. It's the Four Times Square, which is always called the first green skyscraper in New York. Actually, I think any building in New York is greener than the LEED Platinum building almost anywhere else, because if you consider the full life cycle analysis and you consider the context in which it's placed. Four Times Square is a 1.5 million square foot office building that doesn't have a parking lot. And the reason it doesn't have one is that the 6,000 people who work there, 95% of them walk to work or take public transit. If you broke that building up into standard Kansas City style industrial park little office plazas, each one would have a huge parking lot. And they would be spread far apart and would draw all this infrastructure along with it. In New York City, you do the thing that, we build up and all these benefits accrue. I gave a talk once where I said that I suggested that the Nature Conservancy, instead of buying pieces of unspoiled land and preserving them forever, should buy parking lots in dense urban areas and put apartment buildings on them, because in doing that they would both beneficially increase the local population density and then also increase the aggravation of drivers, making more people likely to give up their cars. But usually we do the opposite. So I think we need to do both of those things too. I think economics works pretty well if you use it right. If you put the costs in the right places where people feel them and see them, they tend to act in their own self-interest. Yes?
I just have a comment on education. Having grown up in one of those awful areas, I call where I grew up Levittown, the ground zero of the decline of American civilization. This sprawling culture has such a lock on the American imagination that a lot of people growing up in these environments as kids don't know that there's any real difference, there's any alternative. Yeah. I grew up, when I was a kid, I thought I was going to be a house owner and a car owner just like everybody else. And as soon as I was exposed to an alternative, I took to it like a duck to water. But you got to know there is an alternative you see all the hassles that your parents are going through growing up. You see all the aggravation, the dependence, the slavery that masquerades convenience. It's like you don't know that there is an alternative. You think you're going to fall into the same old world like anyone else, and that's part of the thing. It's firing up the imagination and the culture to show these children that there is an alternative and that there is a lot of advantages to it.
It's interesting too. I think even when I was pretty young, kids playing outside had become a relative rarity, and now it's almost unheard of in the suburbs. You can go for miles through suburbs and not see anybody walking, for example.
I've done it for 5 hours on Long Island. Not seen another.
Much less see, you not only don't see kids outside playing, you don't see anybody walking to a destination. You'll sometimes see people moving between a building and a car, or you'll see them trying to lose weight.
My son now goes to school in Boston, and he tells me how cold it is. He grew up in Westchester, and he was always driven everywhere.
Right.
And so I don't think he ever walked anywhere. And now in the campus, you know, there are these big stretches of walking.
But they have to actually go outside.
He said, it's so cold here. and it just hit me, that's why, because...
Well, it's true. It's very true. It's very true. And
scary.
We'll often read in environmental, well-meaning books about cities and the environment. They'll say that we have to create green spaces in cities so that people will go outside, because people will not go outside in a concrete urban environment. In fact, the opposite is true. If you want to see people outside, don't go to a suburb. Go to New York City, where you sometimes have trouble advancing because there's so many people surrounding you. And you see not only see crowded streets crowded with pedestrians, but you see them at all hours of the day. And then it's beyond unheard of anywhere else in the country except in dense cities. The other place is campuses. And I think that for people who resist the idea of Manhattan as an environmental model, should think back on their college years. And a typical American residential college is a total green role model. People live in very small spaces, very efficiently in small spaces. They walk to almost everywhere they go, to their work, if they're working, and to entertainment. They even eat very efficiently in large groups fed from central kitchens. So, you'll see lots of talk on college campuses where, we put solar panels on the roofs. We have to, we need to do all these things to make our campus green. That campus is probably the greenest moment in that student's life. And if they want to do something really green, cut out the spring vacation in Mexico and stay on campus and just continue walking to their destination. Somebody, when I was in Las Vegas, and somebody there described the automobile to me as a device for conveying air conditioning between buildings. It's also, and yet, it would be foolish to deny the incredible power of the automobile. It's an extraordinarily powerful, attractive thing, and it's not for no reason that we have built this.
Automobile dependence is the cigarette smoking in the 21st century.
Well, that's good, and I think it probably has a similar attraction. A friend of mine was came in the kitchen and saw her 10-year-old son looking gloomy and angry in the kitchen. He was 10, and she said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I wish I had a car." I think getting your driver's license is one of the few milestones in life that really never disappoints, although many New Yorkers don't never even reach it.
They call it the car mitzvah.
A car mitzvah. It's a problem in New York when talking about voter registration and voter rights and the requirement that you have show a driver's license in order to vote. And many New York City residents of voting age do not have driver's license. It's not a problem in other parts of the country. Yes?
Yes, David. I thought one of the best parts of the book was your critique of Lead.
We have some Lead.
Museum. And I was just wondering whether you've gotten much feedback yet on the Lead.
I've been very supportive from people who, I think that I've heard from, I say nothing but mean things about Lead in the book.
Why?
I'll give an example from, since I'm purely an anecdotalist, I'll give an example from a friend of mine built just what is the first LEED Platinum house in Connecticut. It cost about $500 a square foot. It has every conceivable bell and whistle, every green gadget that there is. It's on a 13-acre piece of former farmland. It's 6 miles to the nearest grocery store. It has a.
It's a house.
It's the context that it's in. There's no such thing as a green building. I mean, as a sustainable building, as a sustainable person, as a sustainable office, as a sustainable car. Sustainability is a network, and it's a macro concept. And I think that LEED encourages a tendency, an understandable tendency, to stop thinking at the building skin. Even with the new LEED, the neighborhood development LEED, it's still it treats green as a menu of luxury upgrades, basically, rather than as a true strategy for doing something. And it's understandable because LEED really is, it's a tool for developers, for architects. It's a, the green LEED gadgets have taken the place, really, or they fill the same place that marble kitchen counters and super bathroom and kitchen upgrades did in an earlier period of real estate development. It's what the equivalent in the funeral industry is called. It's called loading the casket. It's those are the easiest parts of a house to make more expensive, and they have the highest margin. And I think it's completely well intentioned, but I think that the consequences are the wrong ones. The way and I think it's also a manifestation of our tendency to think that solutions are tech. We have an environmental problem. We need to invent things to do it. An example I talk about in the book is Natural Bridges National Monument in southeastern Utah. It's a part of the national park network. It's entirely isolated from any power grid, so they had to generated all their electricity with diesel. They had diesel generators. In the 1970s, the federal government turned it into a demonstrative project. They created they made it solar powered, and so it has a little solar field, and it now runs on solar. But in order to do that, they have there's a large room. I think it's 90,000 pound lead acid battery. I can't remember. In a climate controlled room, they have two backup diesel generators. They can run for 2 days off the solar power, but they can't handle the cooking or the heating with it. Those are both done with propane. The vehicles run on diesel. And in order to run even what they have left on the solar, they had to reduce their energy consumption from the diesel days by two-thirds. The reduction by two-thirds is a zero-cost energy cut. We understand the technology for it right now. It doesn't require any investment. You can make that cut to two-thirds. And so to focus on the gadgetry, on the technology, when it has to be, in order to mean anything, it has to be accompanied by this other part, which we already understand, we know how to do, and we can do right now. I think that's where the problem is. And of course we'd rather think, nuclear fusion is going to handle it all, or there's this great new thing where we can grow algae, we feed this to algae, then we feed the algae to the fish, then we catch the fish and we turn them into fuel, we turn the fish into fuel, which is one that I just saw. It would be, it's much simpler, it requires much less investment to eliminate that need just right off the top. Then you don't have to build anything around it. Yes?
I wonder if you have any comments about organized ways of encouraging density, such as the smart growth and new urbanism movements and transit-oriented development and urban growth boundary out in Portland. Your critiques of LEED are interesting and compelling, but I wonder if that extends also to the LEED and the LEED for neighborhoods, where they do try to think on that.
Yeah, they do try to think. It's hard to see how it plays out. I'm sort of skeptical about about almost everything we try to do on purpose in terms of urban planning. And all the brilliant things about Manhattan are entirely unintentional. And almost everything that New Yorkers have done. Many things that Carol shaking your head. Many things that New Yorkers have done have worked in the opposite direction. The idea of creating plazas around buildings, for example, to create open space within the city, they often undermine the very effects that make it green. I think one of the greenest things about New York, and one of the least appreciated features of New York City, is this entirely accidental, naive, self-invented version of this Dutch traffic control feature that people are in love with, that involves blurring the Woonerf, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it. If you blur the distance between car and pedestrian areas, and it's this sort of counterintuitive idea that you slow down traffic not by making it more clearly defined where cars are supposed to go, but by eliminating the boundaries and making it more confusing where the cars are supposed to go. You basically make it ambiguous,
or you put things in the way of drivers and they slow down. New York City has always done this completely accidentally. If you go on a side street, it's riddled with potholes. You can't drive at speed. There's two kind guys smoking a cigarette next to a manhole cover. There's a FedEx truck double parked. There are two kids throwing a football in the street. There are the cars moving at 1 mile an hour, so you can safely jaywalk. These features all have environmental benefit, and they arose entirely. It's like natural selection. They arose all by themselves. Like, oh, it's not intelligent design. It just happened all by itself. I think the human record of doing things on purpose has been less good. There are many exceptions, and Carol knows them. But I think we often. I was just recently in Boston and gave a talk at the Boston Public Library, and there was these beautiful apartment towers right next to it, which had just completely, and they'd clearly been thought out. They had these beautiful big raised plazas around them, and it was just like a total absolute dead zone and blockade. You could not get from here to the library, as I discovered when I went up onto this plaza, because it ended in a fence on this side. There were no stores or any place. There were no people. There was like one person having an illicit conversation on a cell phone. And down the street where the stores were and the hubbub was, it was thronged with people, but here was this place that had been designed to be an attractive urban space. It was actually just a desert drop down into the middle of the city. There are definitely things that there are thoughtful people. I don't think smart growth has always worked out the way it was meant to, same with new urbanism, but it's definitely the right, it's trending in the right direction.
I was going to take the prerogative of asking the last question before we have the wine reception. You can individually ask some questions, and especially because we're relying on the heat above and the heat below in order to keep us
I had an editor at Esquire who said that he grew up in a row house in Philadelphia, and he said his parents always knew when the neighbor on either side got evicted because their heating bill was spiking.
My comment is apropos of the exhibition on Shanghai, which I hope you all look at, and the previous one in Hong Kong. I think it's sort of at our peril that we just look at the U.S. and don't look at the world, because when you look around the world, the world is urbanizing.
Oh yes.
You can't keep people from moving into cities. There, whether it's by rural poverty and the opportunity that's represented by the metropolis, or whether it's a program in China of moving, the largest mass migration in human history, where they're going to move 400 million people off of farms and into the cities. The direction of the 21st century is urbanization.
And it's good. It's a good thing. It's a good thing to densify people. We just need to do it the right way. And
unfortunately, we're not solving the environmental problems with it. China is not pointing the way through density in order to solve those problems.
There's good density and there's bad density. And there's China and India are both. India is an example. India is now building completing this tremendous equivalent of the American interstate highway system. And they're introducing a car that will be within reach of many, many people. It's not a good thing for the future of India, much less the future of resource-hungry United States, for the world to be following this our worst example. It's this apparently irresistible example, but and I think that the discussion of the rest of the world is often framed in this, what right do we as Americans have to tell other people how to live? I think we can say that, we built out our continent, or we're in the process of building it out, according to this this model that does not go all the way to the end. It's if you build a continent that's based on the automobile, you reach a serious crisis point when the automobile becomes economically untenable. And I think it's easier to prevent people from jumping off a cliff than it is to try to stop them once they've begun to fall. And it's a shame, I think, not out of selfish reasons, but out of this, it's like what my father said about his drinking. Well, so maybe I set a good example, negative example for you. I mean, at least we can think that as the world's energy gluttons, we set a negative example for the rest of the world. But it seems instead that we exert this extraordinary power. When I was in China a few years ago, I was in a car with the driver. I was driving a Buick. Which we didn't try to find a Buick in the United States. It's an extraordinarily popular car in China. He was driving a Buick Park Avenue, and down this alley, this centuries-old alley that was so narrow because it was designed for pedestrians hundreds of years ago, that he had to fold back the mirrors on the side of the car to keep them from snapping off. And I said, I'll just run up, and you know, the door of the place we were going was just 100 feet up. And he laughed and like we have a car, we will drive. And even though he had to go this around this way, and it would have taken 2 seconds for me to run up, but we had to drive through honking people out of the way, and people were pressing in the doorways. But there was this, not only was he extraordinarily fulfilled and proud to be driving this automobile, but the people who were getting out of the way seemed to accept it, like, yes, if you have a car, you will drive. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem that the world faces. And there are all these things that we can say, but there is this extraordinary power of the car, and it's I don't know what force other than economics can turn it in the other direction. Oh, and you want to ask the last question?
Yeah, quick question. I feel a little bit like you're positing the environmental movement as a kind of straw man.
Definitely.
To me, it doesn't really work that much. First of all, I think you're exaggerating a bit. Manhattan without Central Park would be unlivable. You know, that's one thing. So there has to be some open space where people can't breathe. You know, we have evolved over millions of years with trees in the savannah. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing is that the cause of sprawl is not the Sierra Club or John Muir. It's all the tax breaks that you mentioned, the externalities, and the fleeing of the middle class from the centers and the refusal to pay taxes and to flee the commons. That's really been the cause of the sprawl, you know, much more than some environmental ethos. So I don't know, that just seems
to be. No, I'm sure. Yeah, I definitely treat it as a straw man. And it's even worse than that.
but the environmental will be just blind to sprawl.
I sometimes try to modify. I say mainstream American or hippie era, but there is a sort of I think that we're not helped by the idea that the way to be good for the environment is to move toward the land, which I think is very powerful in a certain. I know in Seattle, I talked to a group called Great City, which is working to build, densify, and make more pedestrian-friendly parts of downtown Seattle, which are definitely not, and more transit-friendly. And these were young kids, looked like young kids to me, they're probably in their 30s, and they said that the harshest resistance they were getting was from sort of hippie-era environmentalists, who guys in their 60s, who back to the land, the sort of the back to the land idea, who viewed any form of development in the city as a crime. And so I think that this is not the only sort of conflict and contradiction that we have to deal with. I was saying to somebody, I said that for 8 years it was easy to be an environmentalist in the United States. During the Bush years, you could be a purist because the chance that anything would actually happen or anyone would pay attention to what you were talking about was close to zero. By contrast, there's a somewhat different political atmosphere now, and there's also, I think, in the world, there's more of a sense that, you know, we face these grave challenges and we have to do something. And now it's no longer easy because now we encounter all the political realities, and also the environmentalist versus environmentalist conflicts. There was one in the Mojave Desert where there was a proposal to build a very large, a large-scale solar array, and it was killed by environmentalists. And both were right. You know, there was two groups of environmentalists. You see the same thing in Nantucket Sound with the wind turbines versus the pro wind turbine environmentalists versus the anti-wind turbine environmentalists. You see it with hydroelectric, where we had the single most successful source of green power in the history of the United States. The Hoover Dam alone produces more than twice as much electricity as all the photovoltaic panels in the United States through, I think, 2007. I don't know what the numbers are since then. And yet there's an equally powerful, equally rational, equally correct movement that is argues for the taking down of dams, and successfully in many places. So once we start to deal with these things, once they cease to be purely hypothetical, we run into these conflicts. The nuclear is another one where I was talking to someone who's a profound, who is so much more profoundly into all of these issues than anybody else I know, and who is calls himself a reluctant nuclear advocate. And so, but you know, so there. Once you actually start to get in the position of trying to do things, then everything becomes extraordinarily complicated.
So I think our red line is green.